following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Umpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. What you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
I think last week it's still called All of the Above. Yeah, I see how much I remember. I remember that. With Norman Lear, I remember that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had this name now for 95 years, some months, some weeks, some days, some hours, some minutes, some long time.
95 and a half.
And it's taken me every bit of that fucking time to sit here, look at you, and talk about what we're about to do with two incredible women.
Yeah,
that you know very well because you've been working with them.
Yep, Deanne and Eileen. They have. They're the producers of The Middle, a show that I've been on for 9 seasons.
Really, nine seasons.
But I go way back with them. They cast me. We did a show called Three Sisters, and it was.
Wasn't there a play Chekhov?
It was not Chekhov. It was as good, but comedy. But anyway, ran a couple of seasons on NBC with Vicki Lewis and Diane Cannon, Peter Bonners.
Peter Bonners?
Yeah. And great cast. But anyway, so we go way back and they've been very, very, very good to
me. And their names again?
Deanne Heisler, Eileen Heisler, and I get their names wrong.
I heard one of them utter a sound, and they're not even here yet.
I messed up
their
names?
They're opening the door now, but.
And they're here! Deanne and Eileen, welcome!
Hello!
How are you?
That was a quick test. Deanne Heisler,
Eileen. It's always, our names are very confusing because I'm Deanne Helene. Eileen Heisler.
Yeah.
So some people just combine and call it the Helislers. That was one.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah.
And the other thing is that because people were confused, it's Deanne Helene, Eileen, they would say Blackie and Blondie. So our production company is Blackie and Blondie.
Yeah, my hair was darker.
So that's, you could just call us Blackie and Blondie.
Yeah, it'll work. Just
and you
us
have Blackie. Been working together for a quarter of a century.
Oh, I think even more.
Yeah, we met when we were 18.
And you're what, 26 now?
Exactly, a few years ago.
Significantly more than 18 now. It's almost 30 years, isn't it?
Yeah,
I think it's almost 30
years. But professionally, I guess, since we were
right out of college,
NYU Film School.
Yeah. A long time.
Yeah.
And the Middle... Mm-hmm. Is you guys decided on your own that this would be the last season, the ninth season of The Middle. And I saw on Instagram on your Instagram, Deanne, that they broke out the last episode.
We finished the
episode.
Last.
Does that mean
the breaking
is that what
of
break
the
out?
Last? Breaking.
Yeah. Breaking.
Yeah. We finished the breaking of the last episode yesterday.
After nine seasons, the last
nine
episode.
Seasons. Nine
Norman,
seasons
Norman
of
what's
them.
The long, of all your shows, which one went the longest? I can't remember.
It might have been One Day at a Time. Mm-hmm. I think it meant 10 years or something.
Mm-hmm. How many?
Ten.
Yeah. 10 years. Wow.
And do you remember the last day or the last script of each one?
Oh, no.
We won't remember until tomorrow.
I think we did 9 years on All in the Family also.
Wow.
And the Jeffersons may have gone 11.
Wow.
All the shows that are the reasons that we're here. Because that's the soundtrack of our life, for sure, all those shows. But
Norman shows.
Oh, my God,
but yeah, Beyond. We were little, all in the family. My parents would be getting ready to go out. And actually, you don't know this, but I think you indirectly got my parents tickets to a taping of All in the Family when I was very little and very mad that I was not old enough to go.
How did that come about?
I think it was a Harry Kalsheim connection, weirdly enough.
Oh, yes.
Who was my great uncle, who was a William Morris agent.
And he was a William Morris agent. And it's I'm going to tell you about a moment that it isn't worth telling about. it's nothing. And yet it is a moment in my life that is so defined. But, you know, I see Harry Kalsheim as clearly as I see you guys across the table. But I was a client. I never had an agent but for the 6 or 10 months or whatever it was that I was with William Morris at the beginning of my life in this business. Mm-hmm. And Harry Kalsheim was my agent for the
fantastic
little bit of time I had an agent.
That's fantastic.
At William Morris. And I can see his desk and I can see the windows. And it had no relevance in my career, this moment.
Right.
But he was telling me about somebody who in a week or 6 hours or a month, I don't know, from the time of this moment, was going to be a giant figure in my life and for the rest of my life. Mm. He was telling me about this new young kid that we were hearing a lot about called Elvis Presley.
Wow.
And he mentioned a Colonel Parker he was dealing with. And he wished to show me why it was very difficult for getting him on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah.
That he could do radio, but he couldn't do television because he couldn't stop moving his hips when he sang.
Too dirt. Yeah.
And it was very suggestive.
Yeah.
And then Harry attempted to do a little bit.
Oh, my
showing
God.
Me the
That's
moves.
Hilarious.
The agent did a little Elvis for you.
It did. Well, Harry Kalsheim was a, you know, he was in his 60s at this time, I would guess. And very New York or Brooklyn or Bronx,
New York,
Jewish.
Yeah.
And this is your uncle, I think.
My great uncle.
Your great uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, you know, he was embarrassed to be showing me the hip swing.
He was
anyway, it was an
That's
amazing
so funny.
Moment.
Funny.
What an eye for talent.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Norman Lear and Elvis Presley.
Well, Norman Lear.
You both did very well.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
He's got good clients.
But
so you guys met in college.
Yes.
Yeah.
And were you just like TV fanatics? I mean, where did that come from?
Well, you know, all of Norman's shows, my God, you know.
We were TV people.
We were definitely TV people. I remember really, I mean, from such a young age, obviously, All in the Family, you know, was it for me. And really, you know, when you look at The Middle, it is such, it's because we had shows like All in the Family, because I felt like that was the first show that I remember seeing when I was 4. Now,
yeah.
Right.
But that really was combining, obviously, the laughs, but the heart.
Yes. As much drama as comedy and
drama, and just a real family. And so that really was a huge, huge influence.
Yeah. I wonder what percentage of the people listening to us now remember back to Doogie Howser.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah, that was our first show.
That was your first show.
Yeah, we had met in college because I didn't like my dorm room and moved in on the other side of the bathroom from
Deanne. I didn't like your dorm room.
It was awful. It was terrible, but it brought me to Deanne. And we became good friends, and we both ended up transferring to NYU, weirdly. And I was a theater major, and Deanne was in television at that time. And I would, like, act in her projects, and we'd kind of informally start writing together at that time and asking each other's opinions about everything. And somewhere along the way, we decided we wanted to be TV writers, and we were in New York City, and we would write at different places, and we called one the Diner of the Damned because you know how it is when you go to write somewhere, it has to have the right vibe, and we tried one weird place that had a very a New York vibe that was not conducive to comedy writing because everyone in there just looked very miserable. So we moved on to other places. But we
was this a coffee shop? Or
it was like a burger or coffee shop, and we tried it once, and we just called it Diner of the Damned from that point on. But but we ended up deciding. Deanne fell in love with the guy who lived below me in Brooklyn. And so I moved out to L.A. about maybe 3 months before, because she was busy falling in love, and I didn't want to watch that anymore. I let them do their thing. And then she came out, too, and we both took different crazy jobs. And I miraculously got a job working for Stephen Botchko Productions on the Doogie Howser pilot as an assistant to a producer because I could type. I got it through a temp agency, which was insane.
Wow.
It was really, really weird. It was like if I hadn't answered that call and somebody else had in that moment, somebody else would have had that job that ended up 2 years later being the first script we ever sold. And yeah. You were over it. I'll let you tell where
I
you
was
were.
Working for Dan Curtis Productions. He did Winds of War, Warren Remembrance.
Oh, I remember Dan.
You remember Dan? Yeah. And so I would type scripts for him. And at the time, like, he was doing all these, you know, the reboot of Dark Shadows. So we just did a lot of, you know, women in diaphanous gowns running from vampires, you know, and I would help him type up the scripts. And so, yeah, I was an assistant at that time. And I remember when the executive producers of Doogie Howser said, okay, you guys could come over and pitch.
Yeah.
And so we worked up some pitches and we had to go in and pitch to them. And I remember I was so scared. I was shaking and I'm like, I'm not getting out of the car. I can't get out of the car. They can come hear the pitch in the car because I can't get out. And but we pitched and that was our first show.
How did you end up in that position where they invited you over to pitch?
I'll tell you, no one ever invites you really. You have to kind of wedge your way in. Well, I'd been an assistant there for several years and we'd shown people our stuff. And Vic Rosseo and Linda Morris, who were running the show, were very supportive and nice to us. But
so you're writing spec scripts.
Yeah, but nobody was actually, you know, hiring us at that time. And it was very funny because I was in the production office one day and this guy comes in and he said, can I get some scripts because I'm coming in to pitch to Stephen Botchko next week. And I was like, oh, really? How'd that happen?
Well,
and
he said, this was in L.A. or
In L.A. And he said, well, I was selling Stephen Botchko a car and I said I wanted to pitch. And so he said I could come in and pitch. I'm like, wow, isn't that great? I call up Deanne at her job and I'm like, okay, that's it. People who are selling Botchko cars are coming in to pitch. We have to ask. And so that I'm thankful to that guy because it made us ask. And so I called Vic and Linda and said, we have some ideas and we'd like to pitch them to you. And they said, okay. And so I called Deanne and we said, we better get some ideas really fast. And we really humped it and we ended up coming up with the story
you didn't
that
have
they liked.
Them. You were
no, we didn't have them.
Not really, no.
That's kind of like
we got them very quickly. Yeah. Yeah. Very, very quickly.
That's kind of how Norman got started.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, did you?
I had an idea for Danny Thomas, and I called his secretary on the lunch hour, the secretary of his agent on the lunch hour, hoping that the agent would be at lunch, and he was, and I got the secretary, and talking as fast as I could, I said, I'm Norman Lear. I might have used Merle Robinson because that's my favorite name in the history of names.
Merle Robinson?
Merle Robinson. I've always used Merle Robinson. That's a long story because there really was a Merle Robinson in my life when I was 10, 12 years old. I loved him. And so talking as fast as I could, I said I was that person. I just spent 2 days with Danny Thomas. I'm New York Times. I'm at the airport. Oh, God, they're calling my plane. I have two questions to ask him before I get on that plane because I'm writing the story. I'm going to file it when I get there. So, and she gave me his number. So I called his number, and he answered the phone. He was alone in the house with his accompanist, whose name I remember, Wally Pop.
How could you forget that name? Yeah.
And I said, he was interested in how I got his number. And when I told him how I got his number, he laughed. And so he was interested in why I called. And I said we had this piece of material for him, Simmons and I. And he liked me. He said, get over here right away. And I said, well, it's whatever time it was, 12:30, 1 o'clock. I said, we'll be there at 4, by 4. And he said, you said you're in Hollywood. I'm in Beverly Hills. You can be here in 20 minutes.
But, oops.
But we hadn't written this yet.
Oh, God.
There's always a good amount of panic necessary.
So were you writing in the car?
If you're not here by 4 o'clock.
Oh, my God.
And so we wrote this thing. And And he did it for years. He was going to pay us $2,000. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe 30 times over the years. And let's say I'm exaggerating, so it was 12 times. over the years, we would bump into him one place or another. I remember once was on Fifth Avenue. Once was at a party. From across the room, he saw us come in, and he would yell, "It's doing more good at St. Jude." and it did. It was doing more good at St. Jude.
And he never paid you.
He never paid. Did you
ever tell him that you wrote that in a few hours after on the way over there?
He knew the story. He enjoyed the story. Yeah.
So always a bit of desperation involved.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's good advice. Is like sometimes you have to ask.
You have to ask, and
sometimes you gotta just think on your feet.
Well, so your bit went well for Dave Thomas, and obviously your pitch went well.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
So you went from being an assistant to writing an episode.
Yeah, we got to write an episode, and it was really fun. And then I think they had us write another one, and then...
And then we went on to a show called Down the Shore, which lasted maybe six episodes.
Down the Shore, that's what we say in Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's
it was not a great show, but it had very illustrious
I knew people. Her, Dinah Shore.
Might have been better with Dinah Shore.
And then you did some Murphy Brown.
That's when
we did a year of Roseanne. We were on the show Roseanne, and then we went to Murphy Brown, which was fantastic.
Yeah, that taught us everything about how to run a show at Murphy Brown, for sure.
Talk about that for a minute.
It was just when we came on to Murphy, it was the sixth season. And it was like, Roseanne was like, the show was brilliant. We loved writing it. But, I mean, it was just, it's like a war zone. It's a crazy place. And then we went to Murphy Brown, which was just like Diane English and Corby Siamas, who's an amazing writer. And now works on our show.
Yeah, she's consulted with us for 9 years. Our idol. And our mentor ended up working on our show.
Show was just such a well-oiled machine, and it was just such a great place because, the actors and the writers worked together and, just got each other, and it was just such a love fest, and it was just so well-run that really taught us how to really run
now,
a show.
Diane English at that time had a partner. I forget his name.
Joel Schakowsky was her husband, and then he was
She wasn't there when we were there. She had moved.
Right.
But there was a writing partner, I mean.
I don't think so. Unless it was very early on. Not on Murphy.
Yeah. I think Corby Siamas was almost, worked very much with her, but she's
They weren't
a
officially partners, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But we called it like the University of
but
Murphy
when,
Brown.
But when Diane English built the company.
Yeah.
Following Murphy, starting with Murphy Brown.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm not helping myself. I don't remember the name, and if you don't remember
Schakowsky.
The name, why am I?
Well, there was Joel Schakowsky, which was her husband, and who was a producer also on the show. So,
what season did you join Murphy Brown?
It was
six.
So they were gone. She was not there. I think she might have been there in some consulting capacity, but everything was set up so well that it was
Candace Bergen.
Oh, I mean, Candace was amazing, but I mean, Diane English was no longer there.
Yeah.
But everyone, we called it the University of Murphy Brown, kind of, because it just had traditions, it had ways you do things, and there was a lot of honoring of the writing, and it had rules. Like, it was a comfortable place to be, because you knew who was in charge, you knew what was expected of you, you just came in, you felt very protected. It was nice. Mm-hmm. And we didn't work insane hours.
Yeah.
And we Deanne and I run shows like that now. I think we're good students. We need a calendar. We need to know when things are due. And then we have to hit our marks or we get stressed.
do you know what's coming up? What you're going to do after the middle?
rest and relax. And we have a number of things we want to do. Some in TV, and we'd like to do some theater. Like to write a screenplay.
Yeah,
so, we've been doing this for a long time. So we're kind of ready. We'd like to also just stretch our brains and not just do television.
Yeah, we'll see. It's kind of like our plan was like, it's odd to stay with the show for 9 years the way we have in full show running capacity. And people are interested in us doing different things, but we're kind of like, we must take a breath. We must go on a vacation. We didn't really want to monkey bar to the next thing so fast that we hadn't even had 1 second to choose.
So the two women I'm talking to, whoever is listening, the two women across the table who you have been hearing from are related to the fellow on that joins me on the other side of the table,
yes.
Paul Hipp.
That's right.
We're so
we
lucky
have been
to have
doing
Paul.
This for some time now, And a lot of the people we've talked to on this podcast have come out of my life and my background and so forth. And this is the time it's coming out of Paul's life and his background.
Yes. Well,
so, because he's been on the middle and he's been playing this interesting songwriting.
Did you hear the story of how we had, I mean, obviously we'd worked with Paul before, but how we had the idea to put him on the show? Have you heard the story?
Yeah. So, it was weird because we loved Paul from Three Sisters, and we always thought, well, we love Paul, you know, as you love people and would like to use them at some point in life. And I was at a restaurant in Santa Monica and with my husband, and I ran into Paul. And I was like, oh, Paul, we got to get you on the show at some point. You know,
the show had just been picked up.
Yeah, we hug and we do our thing. It was near the end of the first season, I think. And we hug and do our thing. He goes back to his table after we chat. And then I say, oh, I got it. I went, I know the part. I went to Paul, I think, even without checking with my partner. I said, I know the part you have to play. You have to play this singing youth minister. And that's what it's going to be. And then I was like, Deanne, it has to be Paul Hip. And he has to, because it was a weird thing that we'd talked about a little bit.
Well, no, we haven't even talked about that part, but Eileen just sort of came up with it on the fly. And then she came back to me and said, I met with Paul, or I saw Paul, and I know what part he has to play.
I kind of paid attention to him already.
He has to play this,
the youth minister, Reverend Tim. From my perspective, me and I had gone downtown. We saw some play or something. And then we're driving back, and it's like, at 10 o'clock or 9:30, it was a little bit late-ish. It was for L.A. Anyway, so we were going to stop at Cape Mandolini's, but it was full. So we drove to another place, and no place.
We're calling
places. So we ended up at Blue Plate Oystret on Montana in Santa Monica.
It was Blue Plate, regular Blue Plate.
Yeah, and there was Eileen and her husband. And so we, like she said, hugs and everything, and we sat down and we... And Mia goes, you didn't know this. Mia said,
The Mia he's talking about, he's married.
Yes.
Beautiful wife. Yeah.
And she said,
smart. Lovely.
And so we talked, and they went to their table, and they're eating, and then they were finishing, and they were heading towards the door. I said, Here comes Eileen. Because you were looking at, she said in retrospect, you had an idea.
Yeah.
Walked up and said, I got it. You're playing Reverend Tim Tom. He's a youth minister. He plays the guitar and sings. Right? How often in this town do people say something and they're just talking? How often do they follow through? Followed through. Yeah. Here
if
we are.
I say it, I do it. I'm a Midwestern girl. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, 9 years later. Yeah. And I get more love for Reverend Tim Tom because people love the character.
Oh, it's such a great character. And although when you talk about his name, the funny
name
thing is, so after she talked to you, like, all right, so we're developing the character. And she wanted to call him Reverend Tim, and I wanted to call him Reverend Tom. And we don't fight that much, but this was,
on this.
And
one.
When you think about it, who really cares? But we were both just stuck on it. No, it has to be Tim. No, it has to be Tom. And then
I think
Eileen said, what about Tim Tom?
Timothy
like,
Thomas.
All right.
Otherwise known as Tim Tom.
Isn't it interesting? I was thinking of saying, how come it didn't be, it didn't happen to be Reverend Tom Tim?
Yeah, I know.
And
I know.
As I thought that, I thought, it could never happen.
No, right? It doesn't sound right.
Isn't it amazing? if you had 452,000 people here and asked the question one by one, everybody would say Tim Tom, Tom Tim.
Yeah.
It just sounds right.
And that's good writing.
Damn
Which,
straight.
By the way, you're very good at taking things and when a word is off. And Eileen
picky.
Comes in before we shoot it. She's very picky, but it always makes us look better. You realize when stuff's written well, it's written well. You know what I mean? And if you change one thing.
Yeah, we're tough on the ams.
Well, you know, I mean, comedy is music. So, it's
could you say it the way it is on the page? I know.
Yeah.
We're sticklers for our ands and our ums and our buts. And,
but
we're incredibly lucky because, you know, all the songs that that you sing on the show are written by you, and we are we'll just give him a rough idea.
Yeah,
like
tiny.
It'll be like, we want a camping song about Jesus, and we want to make sure we get that, you know, love your mother in there, you know, whatever it is.
Don't get a tattoo.
Yeah, don't get one, and then or don't get a tattoo, or and so you're so great at coming, and we will give him stuff the night before, and the next day he'll have hilarious lyrics.
It's always
way funnier than we could have ever written.
Oh, that's nice.
The songs are great, and so it's such a delight. And when you come in and then do
the table reads
are always just so much fun for everybody.
You think that's a delight? How about when he's opening the envelopes that follow Don't,
there you go. Yeah. Yeah.
How much fun is that?
Yeah, he likes that. Songs, you make you some.
Right.
A little bit. A little bit of buck.
Yeah, they pay the rent. Who'd have thunk it?
We got a dog to support. We got to
I got a dog to support. I got a wife and dog to support.
Who'd have thunk it that you could. Pay your rent with this.
Oh, yes, please.
This was the first one. Do you remember
this one?
Oh,
we tackle issues in the show. For instance, like, what happened to Jesus when he was a teenager?
Oh.
There's a total blackout in the Bible. He's baby Jesus. And then the next thing you know, he's adult Jesus. So we had Jesus was a teenager too. Beneath the pimples, long hair, and awkwardness, King of the Jews. A lonely teenage savior no one could understand. Dorky on the outside, but inside a wise young man. Yeah, Jesus was a teenager too. Wait, listen. His mother made him clean his room, immaculate. He said, everybody talks to me like I'm an idiot. But if you can perform miracles, what good's homework gonna do? Yeah, Jesus was a teenager too.
And boy, did he win over everybody the first, because nobody knew.
That was the first, you remember that.
And nobody knew who he is. We're like, it's Paul Hipp, we know. Yeah. He's a self-contained organism, you'll see. And then got to that point in the table read and the whole table just fell in love.
It was really fun. Yeah. And I learned a lot about what you guys do because I learned from you, front load the funny. You got to get the funny in early, man. And like, so like you have, and you've always had, 22 minutes to tell a couple of big stories. And you got to get the story and the funny in early. Mine is a microcosm of that. I might have four lines.
Yeah.
I might have, you know, sometimes it's great if you have six. Mm-hmm. But you got to set up the song and get the funny in super early. And I tell you, 9 years of doing this, I'm sure I could.
Yeah.
I feel like I could write anything.
Now, we always say we love it, but like we can't wait that long. What if we're long?
That was the first song. What's the last song you've written?
It was with the raffle. With the bingo. Moms Are People Too.
It was Moms Are People Too. But see, here's the other thing. I write them so fast.
And then we
shoot them. That I have trouble remembering them.
I think I remembered something.
But it was Moms Are People Too.
She had hopes and dreams she had you.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Maybe she wanted to.
I can't remember. Moms Are People Too. She had hopes and dreams before she had you.
Maybe she wanted to do something.
It was about the kids. The kids were all taking the mom for granted.
Yeah.
And then Reverend Tim Tom sings a song that just like kind of makes them feel really bad about moms are people too, you know.
Yeah.
She had a whole life before she had you.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe she wanted to do this and do that.
Right.
I should know that. I should have prepared better and have my last song.
Well, there's a nice arc between Jesus was a teenager and mom was a
There's something about the Virgin Mary and
teenagers are people too. We have a lot of moms are people too.
Maybe she wanted to do this.
So where did the middle play?
Where?
And what
network?
ABC.
ABC.
ABC. Oh, yeah. It's an ABC.
It's been anchoring.
We're on
ABCs. We were
Wednesdays 8 o'clock for a long time, and then we got moved a couple years ago to Tuesdays at 8 o'clock, and so we're on Tuesdays now
with Patricia Heaton and Neil Flynn.
The most amazing cast, as you know how important that is.
Patricia Heaton, who's my second favorite Republican.
She is.
Who's your first favorite?
My dad. Gotta be my dad.
You and Patty have to have a show, and then you take that on the road.
Yeah.
That
would be great.
It'd be awesome. We gotta spread the word.
Yeah,
because we have fun with it.
Yeah, she's able to joke. My God, it's really fun. Yeah. I've learned.
You know, we have fun with the politics thing.
What does she do about the president?
I don't think you can
be Republican and still.
I don't want to speak for her politics.
No, I asked her. I said, look, I know you secretly run the Republican Party. You can tell me what's going on. And I said, why couldn't you have given us Kasich?
Right? Yeah. I think she liked Kasich.
Yeah. And she pulled out her phone and said, it's funny you say that. I have a message from him today.
Yeah.
And so I think she was a Kasich fan.
Yeah,
Kasich loves the middle. We like him, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Kasich was a fan of the show.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to speak for either, but I don't think she's a fake fan.
No, no,
I think that would be correct.
Yeah.
Do you think people who, that's what's fascinating to me is that real Republicans, that couldn't stand this guy when he was the candidate. And there was 18 other people, so it didn't look like he was going to get it. But the ones that fall in line behind him now.
Yeah,
like, how is he not abhorrent to Republicans as well? Can you explain that, Norman?
You were on some of your wisdom.
You were on Nixon's enemies list.
I was. And
good for you.
And I hope if he has one, I don't miss being on Donald Trump.
I have a weird... question. Having seen more administrations than we have, are you able to put any of the craziness in any kind of perspective that anyone – I mean
– The rest of us can.
The rest of us who are the emoji that's just staring with wide eyes, you know.
Well, you know, several times a week somebody will talk about it, will say something to the effect that we've never been seen anything like this before. And the first or second or 15th time that happened, I thought, wait a second. There was a time when there was this fool in Italy with the jutting jaw, Il Duce. Mm-hmm. We all called him Il Duce before we learned his name was Mussolini. And there was this joker at the beginning called Hitler, who was an absolute fool. You could tell from... the way he behaved, who then became the danger he became.
Yep.
And all of that, those two clowns, not all that unlike this clown.
Interesting.
You just get to know little by little how much danger there is in each of those clowns.
Yeah, smart to remember.
And in a way, we don't know what danger we could be in now.
No.
But we're finding out
but
every day.
I can feel the threat every day of my life.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it's really crazy.
I do when I see my kids or my grandkids, and I think, oh, wait a second.
Yeah.
They have long lives to live here.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it's a very strange, strange time. It's weird when it was going on and the election was going sort of starting to veer certain ways. I think I said in the movie he wins because you started feeling this – that the most ironic thing ever that somebody would put in a screenplay could be the thing
is going to happen, right? Yeah. Let me ask you this about the show ending: is there pressure to like make another? Is there pressure to go like okay, you just came off 9 years, strike while the iron's hot, make another show immediately?
Just
like your own self and pros, or even your agents?
No. No.
Keep that cash coming in here.
You know what's weird?
The nice thing is, like, this show for us, you know, there's so much of our lives in the show. There's so much. The show was everything that we wanted it to be. So now I kind of feel like everything after this is gravy. Like, I just want to have fun. Like, I just want to, like, what do I want to create? What do I want to do? What do I want to, like, but I don't feel that
you
pressure.
You feel a little
of,
bit less
I
to prove.
Do the next thing.
Like, you feel like all those times when you have something and then the critics say, oh, that sucks. And you're like, hey, I worked really hard. You know, but then with this, I feel like we've gotten appreciation from fans. We've gotten appreciation from critics. But more than that, we've just really had an amazing time. Like, you know, when you're with. Like, when you have a cast sitting across me, we used to say from Murphy Brown, like, it's like great sex, you know, a good table read. Like, the actors know that when they say something funny, you thought of it. And you know when they say it funny, that they said it funnier than you said it in the room. And so it's this great thing that happens.
Oh, reciprocal.
And that's what happens on our show. So, like, it really, you know, is so great that you've scratched a big itch of, like, you know, it's – you know, it's possible if we did something like right away, it would always be not that. You know, you just need a moment to breathe and then see what's next.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
The you know middle. How fun it
it's
is.
It's going to be sad.
It's so sad.
It is sad. We just finished.
Buckets of tears.
We finished breaking the last story yesterday. So we had a lot of tears yesterday.
Did you actually cry?
Oh,
we
yes.
all, we all oh, cried. Yes. Oh, yeah. It's all the writers and crew together. Lots of tears, yeah. When you kind of see that final, you know.
I saw that on Instagram. End of show, end of season,
end of series.
Did you and the network come to the conclusion together that this would be the last?
It's weird. They would have liked more, I think.
They would have liked more.
They definitely would have liked more.
It definitely, you know, there's two things. One is, you know, you don't want to keep going just to keep going. You want to make sure that, you know, the stories you're telling are still fun and compelling and interesting. And then also there is from the studio's point of view, there is a financial consideration because the longer it goes, gets more and more and more and more expensive. So that has to be taken into consideration.
I mean, it was some stuff. It was kind of like, I don't, for a couple years, there were some reasons that there were like kind of 1 year deals with cast, be just because of the way negotiations went, and I think we decided after last year, I think we kept jumping together, us and the cast. It always was very intimate, like us saying, "Do we want to? Are we going to go around again? What do we think?" And it was very important. Our show was kind of like, people hadn't heard of it a lot when it first came out, and it always was a little bit of the stepchild of Modern Family, got more attention and things like that. And there was some, you know, we all felt kind of like we really didn't want, we wanted to go out on our own terms, and we wanted to have a year to know, and we wanted to decide, and we wanted to know and just know it was ending for our own emotional arc, you know, right. And not have anyone sick of it. We didn't want anyone to be sick of it by the time it ended, or the people acting it, writing it, or watching.
Did you ever cry, Norman, when you broke the last script of?
I don't recall crying.
No. Might be
he was stronger than us.
Yes.
But you had like 85 shows going at the same time.
I tried to pick a show to cry about.
You were in like a thousand children. You had so many children. Like, oh, if I lose one, it's all right.
You didn't have time to cry because it's like, okay, that's the end of that show. I got to go down to Maud now. We've got
You know what we did that I just love? I don't know, we did 230 or something like that. All in the Family.
Wow.
But when we were coming up on the 200th episode, the network suggested, or we asked, and they said fine, to do a special on the 200th episode. So what we did was invite the audience, and we did it through some major advertising company in the Midwest someplace, who were very well known at the time, and we had a contest. What's the small theater in the Center Theater Group? The Amundsen, not the Amundsen, that's the middle.
Oh, right. Mark Taper?
The Mark Taper. Yeah. So we got the Mark Taper. I forget how many seats. Let's say it's 1,200 seats or 800 seats. And let's say 800 seats. We invited 400 families from around the country. We invited families to write us and tell us why they wish to attend the 200th anniversary episode.
Cool. That's cool.
And we selected the, you know, 400 or 800 guests. They flew out first class. They were met by limousines.
Wow.
How fun.
They attended in cocktail clothes, tuxedos. They were brought there by a limousine. There was a red carpet. It was just like the opening or the premiere of anything they ever heard about.
Wow.
And it was just, I hosted.
Nice.
Oh, that's
amazing. It feels good, doesn't it? Yeah, really
it was.
That's back when the studio networks spent money.
Yeah. You know what is a weird thing I was thinking of All in the Family? You made two pilots, right? Did you do a
three?
Three.
Wow. And we made two. Including the one that went on the air.
Yeah, I did not know that.
We made two. I remembered hearing that. They didn't stop till they had it.
Yeah.
You made two pilots in the middle.
Yeah,
we did.
Different casts?
Oh, yeah.
Except for Atticus, who plays
Except for Atticus, who's the youngest.
Different networks or same
network?
Same network. Same studio, same network. And to be honest, you know, when we were casting, we kind of knew we didn't have it.
We didn't have it.
But at a certain point, it was like, do you pull the plug on your own show? Do you keep going? To be honest, Eileen and I were like, with the cast we had, we felt like this show can't go.
We didn't want it to
numerous
go.
Years, you know, with this cast. And we were kind of like, the network's like, yes, you know, yes, this to this person, yes, yes, yes. And so we did it and, you know, just muddled through as best we could. But we kind of, you know, we knew it wasn't good. But then they liked the show enough that they kept the actors on hold for a while. And it wasn't a no. They didn't pass on it. But then eventually they kind of let the cast go. Then the writer's strike came. And after the writer's strike, they were like, oh, we don't really have any scripts that we like. Yeah. And we love the script of the middle. Let's try and do it again. And at that point, Patricia Heaton, who'd been on Back to You, a Steve Levitan show, that went down.
Yeah.
And Patty was available. Yeah. And so we got her, and then all the pieces fell into
place.
Yeah,
they called us. Yeah. Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. They called and they were like, what do you think of Patricia Heaton? And it's like, you know, what do you think of Patricia Heaton? What do I think of probably one of the top two, perhaps, comedic actresses there is out there? It was like, we couldn't have even dreamed it, you know? And we went and met Patty for croissants or something. And she liked it. And you know, that got the ball rolling. And as hard as it was to cast the first time, then the second time, it was a little different time of year, which was helpful. But it was like all the pieces just fell into place as beautifully as they had not before.
You know, it's kind of cool that
it was
the show came out of that because It seems to me, being on it and interacting with people, when I go travel, you know, people recognize Reverend Tim Thomas, which is very nice. Yeah. And then I talk to them. But it's like their show. They're very personal about the show. It's like their show. Yeah, this is our show.
Yeah.
And it seems that's grown over the years. I think that's how 9 years, it built the old, kind of the old-fashioned way.
It did.
You know?
Yeah, it's true, word of mouth. And
it came out slow, and then it got its first, second season pick, and then just built and built and built. And now, I mean, the audience for the show, they love the show.
Yeah, I mean, our ratings very ardent have been fans amazing, even in season
switching
nine.
Switching nights. And ratings have not faltered. And saying that it was ending, I think, also made, you know, people think, wait a minute, it's ending, you know, because they started to make sure they stayed tuned in.
Are there many female writing teams running shows now? What was that like when you were coming up?
Not too many teams that I know of. I mean, when we came up, we were like one of the only women.
There weren't a lot. I think being women certainly helped us get hired for sure.
It did.
Oh, yeah. I would say so. When people look for – but then when they'd go, we need some women writers – you know, then
initially,
we were two for the price of one.
How many writers did you have on the show?
On the show?
We have a nine total. That includes Eileen and I.
It's pretty small.
And I think, what do we have?
It's more women than men.
More women
than
men.
Five women, four men.
When we first started, there were not a lot of women showrunners. And early on, you know, it was kind of helpful because sometimes they would say, we came on just as they were realizing we should put women on staff. So it was like, oh, good. You know, like Eileen said, we're two for one. So that was even better. So we would be, you know, one of the staff or maybe one other women writer. And then when we when we made the leap to show running was when they needed a new executive producer for Ellen's
that
show.
Gave us our break.
And they really
wanted
women showrunners, and there weren't a lot. So in some ways, it was helpful early on to be a woman because it was right at that time where they were realizing we should have them.
We leapt over several I think we had been producers. I don't even think we were ever supervising producers on Murphy Brown.
Mm-hmm. And going from Murphy Brown,
then we were executive producers of Ellen. So it was kind of like. It's pretty crazy. We had a meeting, I think, where we thought they're not going to hire us, and then they did.
But now there's so many women showrunners.
And there were
still not enough, but a lot more than there used to be.
But there were the Linda Bloodworth Thomasons and Diane Englishes. Yeah. Those are the people we looked up to, of course, who were doing that. But I think now people are less – you know, I think women always have to work a little harder to get somebody to trust you, unless you're next to a tall man. But now we've been loud enough for 9 years that I think they trust us.
Yeah. That's great. And you've got – Norman, you have a new show that you're
shooting
next
Peter
week?
Oh, yeah, with Peter Tolan, right?
Are you shooting next week?
We're shooting Tuesday, yes.
Oh,
Tuesday
my gosh.
Next.
That's
with Peter Tolan, who we've also worked with.
Love Peter.
Isn't he great?
Wonderful.
Yeah, we're having a great time.
Yeah,
oh, that's great.
So you worked with Peter?
We did. We
on which show?
Well, he'd been on Murphy before us, and then we actually had a deal with Disney at the same time, and he had a – show, what was it called?
Style and Substance,
which didn't go very long, but we consulted on it. So,
on the
and,
show.
And just, he's hilarious and so funny. Yeah. And we actually had we had offices on the same floor on the Disney lot. And, you know, usually writers, I don't know about you, Norman, but a lot of times, you know, like I kind of like hate what I write until someone else says it's good, and you're like, yes, of course, it's brilliant, you know. And it seems like a lot of writers are that way, a lot of self doubt.
Wait, you hate what you write until
you
someone
always
else
feel like you, this you, wasn't you write good, it and you go, oh, I hope it's and good. It and then someone goes, I read this and it's great, and you go, oh, it is.
You grab back your script, you read all the
paper. You're right, that's hilarious.
So
you know, but so, and a lot of writers I know are that way, but Peter was the only one who we would just be working in our office, and all of a sudden, like the door would burst open, and Peter told me, he goes, I just wrote the most hilarious joke. I gotta share this with you. Listen to this. It's hilarious.
He
had, like,
he was right.
He was right. It would be hilarious. But he was like the only writer I know that just like he knew it was great. He was so great that he had to share it with you.
It's through the process. You start to self-loathe a little. Yeah. By the end, you're like, well, here it is.
Do you know, Norman, do you know when you've written a thing?
What I was thinking as you were saying that was at the beginning of my career, Tennessee Ernie Ford.
Absolutely.
So I was hired because I was a close friend of Bud Yorkin's. He was producing the show. I don't know if he needed the writing, but I needed the job, and he hired me. And the great blessing was the head writer was a guy by the name of Roland Kibbe, and I learned more about writing. He became my mentor, Roland Kibbe. I really learned a great deal. Just writing a simple monologue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would write the monologue. I can remember writing that. I can remember the 1 o'clock in the morning telephone calls to my psychiatrist.
Yes,
waking him up and crying.
I'm so glad to hear
because
that.
Because tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, I had to be at the studio with the monologue written, and I... and we would have it, and then I would write it, and I'd go to bed at 3:30,
yeah,
having written the monologue,
yeah,
and then experience the reading the monologue, Ernie reading the monologue, you know, a table full, and hilarity,
yeah,
and marveling like I hadn't written.
Yeah,
it.
Like elves did, oh, it in the middle cool of the night, right? It's fantastic. Yeah.
But this happened a great many weeks.
Yeah,
it happens on multicam, I think, a lot too, because yeah, you end up rewriting into the middle of the night, and you're like, I don't know what we have, and then
can I tell you
something good? You're excited.
Yeah. For the actor, the worst thing is shooting a pilot. I did a pilot one time, and it was every time they took a break, the atmosphere was such, it was intense. And
then
it was, this is it'll remain nameless, the show and the people behind it. But you were made to just feel like every time they took a break, the other actors and myself, we'd all go to our rooms. And then eventually there'd be a knock on my door. And it'd be one of the other actors going, I just wanted to say it's been really fun. I know I'm being fired.
Because they fire people all the time on pilot.
And I would go, right, people get fired. Yeah. Or it'd be me knocking on somebody's door and say, see ya. This went on, it was horrible for a week. Yeah. And I have a picture of myself that I took because I was laying in bed and it was the worst. I just felt like everything that I was second guessing everything I'd done. And I'm laying in bed and I was just like, and I have this picture of me just like that. I wanted to see what I looked like that because the next day you go in and like, hey, that was great yesterday. You know, yeah, we saw the dailies and everything. I was ready to just kill myself. The picture of despair. I guess that's the reverse version
of
yours.
Pilots are like, how are you funny when you have a gun to your head?
When you have
it's
a gun to your head.
It's very hard. Pilots are so tense in the... There's just so many people staring and like, is that going to be funny? You know, we've had people say on certain things like I once had an executive on a show. I won't say which say like this joke. Do you think it's going to be I'm like funny? And they're like,
yeah,
yeah. And I'm like, I hope so. You know, it's like it's a bet, you know, and like you
but
have to trust.
You talk about working before an audience.
I know this was, yeah, with an audience. Yeah. When I said to the executive, I believe it will be funny. We're betting it will. We hope it will.
Mm.
That's all you can do is trust your gut because you don't know. There's no answer.
You don't know. So what can we tell, because we are running out of time, what can we tell the people listening? Let's assume among the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands.
Million.
Or,
million.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't know how large this audience could be, but if there's anyone that wishes to write a pilot, what's the best piece of advice we can give a young writer?
Oh.
Or a middle-aged writer? Or an elderly writer?
Well, I always say, and it's not mine, it's Carl Reiner who said...
I think that was Carl Reiner's
who
advice.
Said... just write from the piece of land that you stand on. And that's what we do.
Yeah, say that again.
Write from the piece of land that you stand on. And it's just, you know, write what you know.
Yeah, what do you know that no one else
and
does?
And the middle really was, you know, we both come from the Midwest and it was our lives and it was – and so I would just say to everyone, you know, you could write different things, but the thing that you're going to really love is the thing that you're, you know.
And they want you to write something. Like, what do you know that nobody else knows? I think when you start – when you start a pilot process trying to think, I bet they'll really like if I write this, I think that's a bad idea. And, you know, the other thing is right at the beginning, be sure to grab them because boring exposition is the death of a good pilot, I think.
Somebody gave me the best piece of advice, or at least I think the best piece of advice about writing was given to me when I was in one of those situations I described earlier where I couldn't get the next thought. I was, you know. What's it called when you are
blocked?
What's the expression
for blocked? Writer's block.
Yeah, writer's block.
Yeah.
What's the matter with you?
writer's block.
And somebody said, "Don't write it, dictate it." He said,
just
"Think
talk.
Of 50 people in the same room. Somebody yells fire. Everybody runs to the door. Some people don't get out because it's only one small door. Let all the ideas out. If you want to assort them according to sex." You can the boys here, girls there afterwards. Tall, lanky, short, blonde, racially, any way you want to do it, you can do it later. think of your ideas like that. Yeah. Let them out that door then assort them.
That's great. Wow. Don't be precious. Like you.
Yeah, no, precious.
And now, on that piece of advice.
Deanne Helene, Eileen Heisler, Norman Lear have just told you all how to write a show. And I just want to say that these guys are guests, Deanne and Eileen. Thank you for the middle. Thank you for being such great, the best bosses on the planet.
Thank you.
Thank you, best bosses on the planet.
Thank you.
Norman Lear, all of the above. Good night and good luck.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Gibb.
And life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.
Hi, this is Lillian Garcia, host of Chasing Glory here on Podcast One. Every week I'm talking to the biggest athletes and entertainers about their journey to success.
Did you hear this week's episode?
Stephanie McMahon is on Chasing Glory.
Thanks for having me, Lillian. That was quite an introduction.
The highs.
Let me just say that announcing the first ever Women's Royal Rumble was one of my most memorable moments.
And the lows.
I've almost been fired numerous times. It hasn't always been pretty.
This week, I keep it real, raw, and inspiring with WWE's Stephanie McMahon. Everything you want to know and didn't know.
What do you feel like having three daughters for Triple H has meant to him?
Make sure to subscribe and download new episodes every Monday of Chasing Glory with me, Lillian Garcia. You can get it exclusively on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, or on the all-new Podcast One app.